The content of this program is intended for blind and print impaired people. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service. And for the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit G. Suggs Insurance. That's G-S-U-G-G-S insurance.com. Or call 919-875-8889. Today's edition of Time Magazine is dated February 14 through February 21, 2022. This is the cover that has no perceptible red border, as is usual. It has a very pencil-thin white inner border over much of the cover, but not all. Time is in large white block letters superimposed upon red on the left and black on the right, main colors of the cover. The red portion, the black portion is solid, but the red portion looks like little asterisks or satellites. It is the COVID-19 emblem that does in fact look like a little sphere, and in this case red with white or black dots, black dots or holes, whatever they're supposed to be comprised of, with little spokes around the edges. And the other side, beginning with larger blobs of red and almost disintegrating into tiny pencil point shapes, then that runs into the rest of the black front cover border. Beginning today with an article entitled "The Road to War: Ukraine Went After Putin's Friend, Russia Readied an Invasion. Inside the Power Struggle That Brought Europe to the Brink," by Simon Schuster, KYIV. That's K-Y-I-V. Great wars sometimes start over small offenses: a murdered duke, an angered pope, the belief of a lonely king that his rivals are not playing fair. When historians study why armies began gathering in Europe during the plague of 2021, their interest might turn to a teenage girl, the goddaughter of Moscow's isolated sovereign. Her name is Daria, D-A-R-I-A, a young Ukrainian with a shy smile and big brown eyes. When she was born in 2004, her parents asked their friend Vladimir Putin, then a few years into his reign in Russia, to christen her in the Orthodox tradition they all share. The girl's father, Viktor Medvedchuk, has been close to Putin for decades. They holiday together on the Black Sea. They conduct business. They obsess over the bonds between their countries and the Western forces they see pulling them apart. "Our relationship has developed over 20 years, Medvedchuk told me in a rare interview last spring in Kyiv, near the start of the current standoff between Russia and the West over Ukraine. I don't want to say I exploit that relationship, but you could say it has been part of my political arsenal." Putin could say the same about Medvedchuk. That's M-E-D-V-E-D-C-H-U-K. The leading voice for Russia interests in Ukraine. Medvedchuk's political party is the biggest opposition force in parliament, with millions of supporters. Over the past year, that party has come under attack. Medvedchuk was charged with treason in May and placed under house arrest in Kyiv. Just last month, the U.S. accused him and his allies of plotting to stage a coup with help from the Russian military. Throughout his 21 years in power, Putin has seen Ukraine as a fraternal nation, tied to Russia by bonds of faith, family, politics, and a millennium of common history. He has spent the past 7 years using every tool at his disposal, including coercion and outright invasion, to preserve those ties as the Ukrainian people increasingly turn toward the West. Short of war, one of the best ways Putin has to influence Ukraine is through Medvedchuk and his political party. So it should not be surprising Russia's military standoff with the West has escalated in step with the crackdown against his friend. Last February, days after the inauguration of President Joe Biden, America's allies in Kyiv decided to get tough on Medvedchuk. The Ukrainian government started by taking his TV channels off the air, depriving Russia of its propaganda outlets in the country. The U.S. Embassy in Kyiv applauded the move. About 2 weeks later, February 19, 2021, Ukraine announced it had seized the assets of Medvedchuk's family. Among the most important, it said, was a pipeline that brings Russian oil to Europe, enriching Medvedchuk and his family, including Putin's goddaughter, Daria, and helping to bankroll Medvedchuk's political party. The first inkling of Putin's response came less than 2 days later, 7 a.m., February 21. In a little-noticed statement, the Russian Defense Ministry announced the deployment of 3,000 paratroopers to the border with Ukraine for large-scale exercises, training them to seize enemy structures and hold them until the arrival of the main force. Those soldiers were the first in a military buildup that has since grown to more than 100,000 Russian troops. In their scramble to respond, the U.S. and its allies have sent plane loads of weapons to Ukraine and thousands of troops to secure the eastern flank of the NATO alliance. The resulting standoff has revived the tensions of the Cold War and pushed Europe to the brink of a major military conflict. In trying to discern Putin's motives, observers have raised his strategic wish to humble the Americans, divide the Europeans, and restore Moscow's influence over the lands it controlled before its empire crumbled in 1991. But the roots of the crisis have been overlooked. To understand Putin's objectives, you have to understand both his personal and political ties to Ukraine, as well as his long-standing aim to bring the nation under his control. When Medvedchuk was placed under house arrest, the Russian leader called the attack on his proxies an absolutely obvious purge of the political field, one that threatened to turn Ukraine into Russia's antithesis, a kind of anti-Russia. Few people have a clearer vantage on Putin's response than the alleged coup plotter Medvedchuk. In the year before the crisis escalated, he met with Putin several times at his residence near Moscow, despite the pandemic protocols that have kept the Russian leader isolated from all but his top aides. The question that now fills headlines around the world, what does Putin want, is not a matter of conjecture for his closest friend in Kyiv. Pausing now to note a couple of photographs here. One of Medvedchuk with Putin near Moscow in October 2020. Now, these two gentlemen are both dressed in black business suits, black shoes, white shirts. One of them's wearing a light blue tie. One of them is wearing kind of a purplish mauve tie. They both have blondish gray hair. One can see the watch on the left hand of one of them. Now, left to right, these are Mr. Medvedchuk and Mr. Putin. They're seated in comfortable, stylish, beige-colored armchairs, one on either side of a round coffee table in the center, upon which there appears to be a green coffee cup and perhaps a white notepad, a very, very, very small floral display on a shelf behind them, which is also the off-white, creamy beige color of the chairs. They seem to be very comfortable in one another's presence. And then the next photograph is Mr. Medvedchuk with his daughter, Daria, both dressed very casually, Mr. Medvedchuk still wearing the rather large and technological-looking watch on his left wrist. The little girl is wearing a casual attire in pink and white. They're standing on what appears to be a side street somewhere, lit by overhead bulbs in a decorative way. And they are on vacation, it says. It took me a while to find Medvedchuk's office amid the alleys of the old city center. The address led to an old apartment block near the end of a steep slope, with no outward sign of its political significance. Behind the unmarked door, a handful of armed guards looked at me in silence. One proceeded to search my bag, demanding to know whether it contained a knife or any kind of shiv. Medvedchuk was more cordial. Dressed in a fitted blue suit, he had the look of a Ken doll's father, stiff, tanned, manicured, with an angular jaw. Upon entering the conference room, he strutted over to a thermostat and asked, "Are you warm enough?" The story of his friendship with Putin, he said, goes back to the early years of Putin's presidency. Medvedchuk was chief of staff to Putin's counterpart in Kiev, and they often met at official functions. At the time, Russia had all the influence it wanted in Ukraine. Ukraine's economy depended on Russia for cheap gas and cheaper loans, and its leaders had no intention of joining any Western alliances. To strengthen their bond with the Russian leader, Medvedchuk and his wife, a famous news anchor in Ukraine, asked Putin to be the godfather of their newborn. They've stayed close ever since. In one interview on Russian state TV, Medvedchuk recalled how Putin doted on Daria, bringing her a bouquet of flowers and a teddy bear when he visited the Medvedchuks at their villa in Crimea. Their friendship only grew closer after 2014 when a revolution tore their countries apart. Protesters built an encampment on Kiev's central square that winter, demanding Ukrainian leaders fight corruption and integrate with the West. More than 2 months of clashes with police ended on a frigid February morning when security forces opened fire on the demonstrators, killing dozens of them in the streets. The regime collapsed the following day. Its leaders fled across the border to Russia. And as their political party fell apart, so did the machinery of Russian influence over its neighbor. There is no legitimate authority in Ukraine now, Putin fumed in a speech at the Kremlin that spring. No one to talk to. The revolution, he claimed, was nothing more than a U.S.-backed coup, and he responded by ordering his troops to invade. After swiftly taking over Crimea, Russian forces moved into the coal-mining heartland of eastern Ukraine, installing separatist puppet regimes in two of its biggest cities. Crimea, by the way, is on the southern border, or the southern portion of Ukraine, both of which are adjacent to Russia on the east. As Ukraine fought back in the east, its capital became a political battleground. The remnants of the pro-Russian establishment set out to build new parties in Ukraine, each vying for the old regime's voters. "We knew Putin does not want chaos and war in Ukraine in the long term," says an advisor to one of the Ukrainian oligarchs who funded the parties. "He wants a protectorate, a loyal government, like he had before." Russia's allies in Kiev wanted the right to run for office, to build up industries, to control TV networks. As the Russian lawmaker Konstantin Zatulin explained to me at the time, this would be our compromise. Russia would have its own soloists in the great Ukrainian choir, and they would sing for us. Under that arrangement, he added, we would have no need to tear Ukraine apart. The U.S. was not open to that kind of deal, and the Obama administration took a hard line against Russia's operatives in Kiev. Many of them were sanctioned right after Russia invaded in March 2014. Medvedchuk was at the top of the blacklist. Still, by the end of 2018, the pro-Russian parties achieved a breakthrough in Ukraine, forming an alliance called Opposition Platform for Life. Backed by billionaires sympathetic to Moscow, they own three television networks in Ukraine. And their party's chairman was Putin's old friend, Medvedchuk. During elections held the following year, Ukraine voted in a new president, an actor and comedian named Volodymyr Zelensky. His popularity derived from a hit sitcom called Servant of the People, in which he starred as a fictional president. 3 months later, Zelensky's political party won a majority in parliament, but Medvedchuk's faction came in second place, making it the biggest opposition force in the country. "Millions of citizens voted for us," Medvedchuk told me. "Putin gave a promise to protect them." Medvedchuk's TV channels worked to weaken the new government. "They were eating into the electoral base, just destroying Zelensky," said the president's first national security advisor, Oleksandr Danyluk. The networks were especially relentless in attacking the government's response to the COVID-19 pandemic and its failure to secure vaccine supplies from Western allies. When Russia released its own vaccine in August 2020, Medvedchuk, his wife, and their daughter Daria were among the first to get it. They then flew to Moscow to talk to Putin. It was the first public meeting the Russian leader had with anyone, unmasked, on camera, and without social distancing, since the pandemic began. Their talks that day resulted in a deal for Russia to supply Ukraine with millions of doses of its vaccine and to allow Ukrainian labs to produce it free of charge. When Medvedchuk brought the offer to Kiev, the government rejected it, so did the U.S. State Department, which accused Russia of using its vaccine as a tool of political influence. But as the death toll mounted in Ukraine and no vaccine shipments arrived from the West, voters turned away from Zelensky in droves. By the fall of 2020, his approval ratings fell well below 40%, compared with over 70% a year earlier. In some polls taken that December, Medvedchuk's party was in the lead. Zelensky grew especially concerned about the party's television channels, which he condemned as messengers of Russian propaganda. When he decided to take those channels off the air last February, it was not only a defensive move, says Danyluk, his former security advisor. It was also conceived as a welcome gift to the Biden administration, which had made the fight against international corruption a pillar of its foreign policy. As Danyluk put it, that's Danyluk, and I apologize for mispronouncing it, "the decision to go after Putin's friend was calculated to fit in with the U.S. agenda." Throughout the ensuing military crisis, the U.S. has had no ambassador in Kyiv. The last one, Marie Yovanovitch, was fired in April 2019 after she ran afoul of President Trump's campaign to extract political favors from Ukraine. Trump wanted the Ukrainians to investigate the Biden family, and he froze military aid to Kyiv as a means of pressure. The resulting scandal led to Trump's first impeachment in the House, and it left the U.S. embassy in Kyiv hollowed out and demoralized. "My chain of command went to SHIT, says Saria Jayani, who was then a senior diplomat at the embassy. We just disappeared. That did not change," she says, after Biden took office last year. "His top foreign policy staff was focused on confronting China," she says. "And they tended to see Russia as a nuisance to be managed or ignored. His team did not care about Russia," Jayanti told me in Kyiv last fall, shortly before she resigned from government, "and they did not want to hear about Ukraine." Only in recent days, nearly a year into the crisis, did Biden pick a new ambassador to Kyiv who has not yet been installed. A senior U.S. official tells Time, "Ukraine's always been a top priority for the administration. There's been very extensive and almost constant focus on Ukraine from day one. When the Zelensky government decided to go after Medvedchuk, the U.S. welcomed it as part of Ukraine's struggle to counter Russian malign influence," the official said. The methods used in this struggle have been novel and controversial. Rather than working through the justice system, Zelensky's imposed sanctions against Ukrainian tycoons and politicians, freezing their assets by decree. This strategy, which the government calls de-oligarchization, has targeted many of Zelensky's domestic opponents, and in particular, their television channels. The U.S. has avoided criticizing the crackdown, not wanting to micromanage what Ukraine was doing, said the senior U.S. official. But in the case of Medvedchuk, the U.S. embassy cheered Zelensky on. "We support Ukraine's efforts to protect its sovereignty and territorial integrity through sanctions," the embassy said in a tweet last February, the day after the sanctions froze Medvedchuk's assets. The party leader was furious. "This is political repression," Medvedchuk told me. "All my bank accounts are frozen. I cannot manage my assets. I cannot even pay my utility bills." In April, as Russian forces assembled at the border, Zelensky traveled to the front lines to meet his troops and invited me to come along. Military helicopters got us most of the way to the trenches, but the last few hundred paces required a hike through the mud with a handful of soldiers and bodyguards. One of them lugged a big machine gun with boxes of shells latched to his belt. The president spent the day talking to his troops, dining with them, and handing out medals. Considering the number of Russian tanks poised to invade from across the nearby border, he seemed remarkably upbeat. We spent the night near the garrison, and he arrived at the mess hall for breakfast in a tracksuit, fresh from a morning jog through the war zone. On the flight back that day, we talked about Medvedchuk and his TV networks, and whether it seemed wise in hindsight to shut them down. "Zelensky made no apologies. I consider them devils," the president told me. "Their narratives seek to disarm Ukraine of its statehood." As the Kiev skyline appeared through the window and the plane began to descend, Zelensky grew upset. "Al Capone killed a lot of people, but he got locked up over his taxes," he told me. "I think these TV channels killed a lot of people through the information war." Some of his advisors, especially in the intelligence community, were less enthusiastic about the move against Medvedchuk. "At least he's the devil we know," one retired spy chief told me in Kiev, agreeing to discuss the issue on condition of anonymity. Since Russia first started the war in 2014, Medvedchuk has served as one of the lead negotiators in numerous rounds of peace talks, often winning the release of prisoners of war. "He has direct access to Putin," the spy chief told me. "That kind of access is rare, and it has made Medvedchuk an effective mediator." Zelensky was not moved by such arguments. May 12, about a month after our trip to the front lines, Ukrainian authorities issued an arrest warrant for Medvedchuk. Prosecutors alleged he'd profited from the Russian occupation of Crimea, and they charged him with treason. A court ordered him to remain under house arrest pending trial, cut off from his voters, and prevented from attending sessions of parliament. U.S. law enforcement went after his allies. Oleh Voloshin, a prominent member of Medvedchuk's party, was greeted by the FBI when he arrived in Washington last July. Two agents approached him at Dulles International Airport and asked to have a word in private, away from his wife and infant son, who were traveling with him. Voloshin, who serves as Medvedchuk's envoy in the West, spent the next 3 hours answering the agent's questions. "They took my cell phone," Voloshin told me of the incident, which has not been previously reported, "and they took all the information from my cell phone." In a statement, January 20, the U.S. government leveled an astonishing series of allegations against Voloshin and Medvedchuk. It claimed they're part of an ongoing Kremlin plot to install a puppet government in Ukraine, propped up by a Russian military occupation. Russia has directed its intelligence services to recruit current and former Ukrainian government officials to prepare to take over the government of Ukraine and to control Ukraine's critical infrastructure with an occupying Russian force, said the statement from the U.S. Treasury Department, which imposed sanctions on Volochin and other alleged plotters. When we spoke by phone the following day, Volochin had already pulled his money out of the bank and was preparing to leave Kiev with his family. Maybe Serbia, he said of his destination. Maybe Russia. He told me he has no intention of taking power in Ukraine with help from the Russian military, and said the aim of his party was always to win power peacefully, either through elections or, as Volochin put it, a diplomatic compromise between Russia and the West. There's no third option, he says. Russia either gets the influence it wants by peaceful means, or it gets it by force. With Medvedchuk sidelined and his party in retreat, the Kremlin has no clear path to influence over Ukraine through politics, and that raises the temptation to use hard power, Volochin told me. You have to understand, he says, there are hawks around Putin who want this crisis. They are ready to invade. They come to him and say, look at your Medvedchuk. Where is he now? Where is your peaceful solution? Sitting under house arrest. Should we wait until all pro-Russian forces are arrested? Nearly 12 months since it began, the crisis in Ukraine has become far bigger and more dangerous than any political grudge. In early December, as over 100,000 Russian troops stood at the border with Ukraine, Biden held a call with Putin to defuse the tensions. According to the White House, the president offered to hear out all of Russia's strategic concerns, opening the door to a far more sweeping set of talks. It was a breakthrough for Putin to get a U.S. president to engage with him on the future of the NATO alliance, which Putin has long described as the main threat to Russian security. The response from Russian diplomats smacked of an old negotiating tactic, start high. They demanded a written guarantee from the U.S. that Ukraine would never join NATO. They also told the U.S. to withdraw its military forces from Eastern Europe, retreating to positions they held before Putin took power. As the lead Russian envoy put it ahead of talks in January, NATO needs to pack up its stuff and get back to where it was in 1997. Rather than defusing the standoff, Biden's overture allowed Russia to air a long list of grievances against the West, unleashing what one Kremlin insider in Moscow described to me as an enormous pile of pent-up tensions. As the talks progressed through January, Russians came to believe they had the upper hand as long as they could keep up the military pressure on Ukraine. It is the perfect time to make some trades, get some sanctions removed, talk about security concerns, says the Kremlin insider, who agreed to discuss the negotiations on condition of anonymity. The logic's simple, the source adds. If we do not put a lot of fear into them, we will not get to a clear solution, because that's just how the Western system works. It's very hard for them to reach a consensus on something. All those moving parts, all those checks and balances, each one pulling in different directions. So the aim is to present a threat of such massive consequences that it forces everyone on that side to agree. The gambit appears to be failing. The U.S. has rejected Russia's core demands out of hand and prepared a raft of sanctions that would cut off much of the Russian economy from the rest of the world. The gradualism of the past is out, and this time we'll start at the top of the escalation ladder and stay there, says a senior administration official. Biden's begun to warn Ukraine and other allies that that a Russian invasion looks imminent. Over 8,500 U.S. troops were put on high alert in January, prepared to deploy to Eastern Europe alongside naval ships and warplanes. The State Department ordered non-essential staff and family members to leave the U.S. embassy in Kiev, it said, out of an abundance of caution. It is far from clear whether peace talks can bring Europe back from the brink of war or what Putin might consider a face-saving compromise. Under the Kremlin's pandemic protocols, the Russian leader's been more isolated during this crisis than at any point in his career. In early January, when he would normally celebrate Orthodox Christmas among the crowds at a Russian cathedral, the Kremlin issued footage of the president alone with a priest solemnly holding a candle in the chapel of his private residence. Very few people can speak to him now, the Kremlin insider told me. The world inside his head is only his own. In Kyiv, Putin's friend is even more isolated. Stripped of its main TV channels and beset by criminal charges, Medvedchuk's party's been sinking in the polls. Medvedchuk remains under house arrest with a tracking device affixed to his ankle and police officers stationed outside his home. His daughter's security was such a concern he declined to say anything about her whereabouts. But one of his associates told me that Daria remains in Kyiv, surrounded by private security guards. The main concern, the associate said, is kidnapping. But yes, she is still here. That lengthy article was written by Simon Schuster with reporting by Leslie Dickstein and Simone Shaw, New York, Brian Bennett, W.J. Hennigan, and Nick Popley, Washington. The next article on the verso of that last page is also about Europe. It's a viewpoint, and it is one page long, by Bruno Macias, M-A-C-A-E-S, who was Portugal's Secretary of State for European Affairs and is author of Geopolitics for the End Time. Viewpoint, Europe must learn to stand up for itself. There's a photo here. It's very gray. The sky in the background is gray. The building in the foreground is gray. There is a flag flying in front of this very tall, very gray building surrounded by very gray concrete and some white snow. The flag is two-tiered. It's yellow on the bottom and dark blue on the top. The caption reads, Ukrainian soldiers hold a building in battle-scarred Avdiivka in the Donetsk region. A consensus is beginning to form that a new war in Ukraine has become inevitable. In large measure, this is due to the escalation in both rhetoric and military preparedness coming from Moscow. Combined, they create a situation where the costs of retreating for Russia might now be too high. At present, it seems very unlikely the Kremlin will get more than symbolic concessions from Washington, much fewer than it perhaps hopes to get after more concrete tokens of Russian determination. Vladimir Putin is less interested in substantive commitments than in the spectacle of Russian assertiveness and American retreat. The question, were Russia to make a move, is what kind? Kremlin insiders, like longtime foreign policy advisor Sergei Karaganov, have downplayed the prospect of an invasion followed by territorial occupation. Instead, new incidents may be manufactured in the coming days, after which Putin would address Russia, explaining he had no alternative but to order a series of airstrikes and limited ground operations against targets inside Ukraine as a way to eliminate a threat to Russian interests. His goal would be to degrade Ukrainian defense capacities, provoke a political crisis in Kyiv, and affirm a new president for Ukraine and beyond, a symbol of imperial power rather than an ugly battle for territory. European countries remain deeply divided over what level of Russian aggression should trigger sanctions, with Germany even pushing for an energy exemption in proposed dollar sanctions on Russia. Given these constraints, the Western response might be kept within certain limits, but neither Ukraine nor world politics would survive unchanged. The existing security order in Europe would be broken beyond repair. Europeans would suddenly be living in a world where Russia would have a claim to intervene anywhere in its near abroad or even beyond, anytime it felt important interests were at stake. The military endgame is unlikely to be the prolonged and costly battle for territorial control over Ukraine that Western leaders keep warning Moscow about. The crisis is not about Ukraine, but about Russia. If Washington's serious about limiting Russian power, it should focus less on what comes after a Russian attack than on offering Ukraine the tools to defend itself, especially during the initial stages of conflict, when air and standoff missile strikes would be deployed against military bases, power plants, key transportation nodes, and other critical infrastructure. We no longer live in the old liberal order where rules must be enforced and violators punished. We live in a new order where power must be balanced with power. The U.S. must reflect on whether it can afford to reduce its presence in Europe before a proper counterweight to Russia has been created in Brussels. As for Europeans, they need to quickly prepare themselves for a new world where their sovereignty and security may well be at stake. Economic sanctions may influence how the Kremlin plans its actions in the next few months and years, but they cannot change the underlying dynamics. The existing order is starting to buckle, and Washington needs to decide how best to replace it with new arrangements. Does it prefer to reach a grand bargain with Moscow, whereby the two powers divide Europe among themselves? Or does it prefer to encourage and support the development of a new European pole, capable of balancing Russian power? Should Joe Biden spend the rest of his term in fruitless summits with Putin, or should he sit at the table with the EU and Britain to discuss how Europe can become a sovereign actor in foreign policy and security? What is frustrating about the crisis is how we keep avoiding the larger questions of political order. Eurasia, the supercontinent, is being reshaped before our eyes. The next article is Dog Runs, how a nationwide network has saved millions of pets by moving them north. This is by Andrew Blum, or Blum, B-L-U-M. There are lots of photos of dogs here, big and little and medium-sized, all colors, brown and white together, tan and white together, tan alone, big blue eyes, big brown eyes. Here's a black and tan dog with a bunch of stainless steel bowls beside it. Here's another photo of a black and white dog being held by a person, looks like a woman, Danielle Bowes, wearing blue coveralls, and they're standing outside next to some large plastic kennels for containing a dog, a crate, or shipping a dog, because it looks like they're going places here. This is a photograph, Cheryl Blancato of Second Chance Animal Services. Well, we actually don't see Cheryl here. We see the dog. Carries two-month-old Presley. Presley's in a kennel, a plastic cage here, who flew from Mississippi to Massachusetts. And he's still on the tarmac or being carried by Cheryl, who's outside this picture somewhere. But there's a little ATV. I'll bet that's what's going to haul, what's his name? Presley, from the airport tarmac into the terminal. Here we go. The dusty white cargo plane stood out among the gleaming corporate jets, as did its passengers. 48 barking dogs newly arrived at the private air terminal at Hanscom Field outside Boston. Did I tell you that the photographs are by Evan Angelastro for Time, and the article's written by Andrew Blum, or Blum? They had left Mississippi that morning with their health certificates taped to their kennels. All week, the staff at Oktabaha County Humane Society, OCHS, in Starkville, Mississippi, had been getting them ready, giving them their shots, testing their temperaments, color-coding each crate for its destination. Here we go. The destinations are red for Second Chance Animal Services in North Brookfield, Mass. Gray for the Animal Rescue League of Boston. Blue for the MSPCA, an independent animal welfare organization. On the tarmac, representatives from each jostled around the animals like vacationers at baggage claim. Danielle Bowes, a staff member at Second Chance, checked her list. She was looking for two tiny puppies named Tiger and Presley. Now, this guy in the photograph does not look too tiny to me, but maybe he's enlarged. Black and brown four-month-olds, Bandit, Josie and Wells, an adult lab mix, Trent, and a dozen more, ranging from 8 pounds to 40 pounds, from 8 weeks to 4 years old. When she found Bravo, a one-year-old collie, an American blue heeler mix, she cooed into his cage, "Hi, pretty, you're going to go quick." Back at Second Chance, the dogs will quarantine for 48 hours, per state law, before they go up for adoption. If past experience is any guide, and transports like this arrive nearly every week all over the country by plane, truck, and van, they'll be gone in a few days, becoming the newest of the estimated 90 million canines living with U.S. families. There's not a dog shortage in America, not yet at least, but there are stark geographic differences in supply and demand. Massachusetts needs more dogs, and Mississippi has too many. The same is true of Delaware and Oklahoma, Minnesota and Louisiana, New York and Tennessee, Washington and New Mexico, among other states. To compensate, sophisticated dog relocation networks have sprung up over the past decade, transporting dogs and cats from states with too many to states with too few. Mostly it's a tactical problem. How do we connect those shelters that have too many animals and are at risk of euthanasia simply because they were born there to those shelters where these animals are going to fly off the shelves? Says Matt Bershader, B-E-R-S-H-A-D-K-E-R, CEO of the ASPCA, the New York-based animal welfare giant, which sponsored and organized the flight arriving at Hanscom. Over the past 5 years, the ASPCA has poured resources into its relocation program, which in March will celebrate its 200,000th animal moved, but it is far from alone. These pipelines of adoptable animals, primarily but not exclusively moving from south to north, have become a cultural phenomena in their own right and a key part of a broader transformation of companion animal welfare. The ASPCA's program may be the biggest and most organized, but dogs, and to a lesser extent cats, move by all sorts of other means. There are ad hoc bands of volunteers organizing on Facebook and Pet Finder who cover their back seats with towels and rendezvous at rest stops, passing animals along every couple hundred miles in big cities and their suburbs. Nonprofits have sprung up to partner with overcrowded southern shelters, hire a driver, load up a van with a few dozen animals every month or more. During the COVID-19 pandemic, many of these groups became overwhelmed with demand in some states, leading to months-long waiting lists and stiff competition among adopters. That spurred a surprising fourth category, veritable smugglers, who saw an opportunity in loading up a horse trailer with the cutest strays and driving north, leaving the nonprofits with the sick and less desirable animals. It's a good time to be an American dog. In the 1970s, as many as 20 million dogs and cats were euthanized each year. That number has declined precipitously. ASPCA now estimates 390,000 dogs and 530,000 cats are euthanized each year, down from 2.6 million as recently as 2011. That's still too many, especially when a way to further reduce the numbers at hand. Euthanasia was once seen as an inevitability. There were just too many animals. but a combination of factors, cultural, medical, political, has changed that. More people want mutts, rebranded, rescues. Fewer animals are born each year, thanks to broader spay and neuter programs, often dictated by law, and improved surgical techniques. And more are being moved, which helps save those animals, but also opens up space and time to care for others left behind. For shelter staff who suffer from a disproportionately high rate of mental health problems, nothing matters more than keeping up with the animals' needs, rather than being beaten down by the incessant necessity of euthanizing an unwanted, they're buoyed by a steady flow of adoptions. Money helps, of course, the geographic disparities that lead one place to have too many dogs and another too few are primarily fueled by a difference in resources. Shelters in heavily populated cities and suburbs benefit from well-funded population control programs and large pools of potential adopters. Shelters in rural areas can struggle with excess animals and communities with broader economic burdens. Puppies flying private may seem excessive. The flight into Hanscom costs the ASPCA approximately $30,000, but the kennels on the tarmac among the corporate jets are an indicator of the broader success of the animal welfare movement and the enthusiasm of its donors. The easy problems are nearly solved. The hard ones require a new approach. Animal relocation is not only about meeting demand for puppies, but also building the capacity to help all animals. The ASPCA-sponsored flight exemplifies an organized effort to connect disparate communities in pursuit of a common goal. It is a living, breathing, barking, panting, geographic arbitrage. By treating these flying puppies as points of connection between communities, like the knots in a net, the issue of excess animals can be addressed. It's a recognition that some problems, even ones that bridge red states and blue states, can be solved together. Now, here's a small graphic that primarily is a map of the U.S., and it's color-coded, and I'll try to describe it. Among the thousands of organizations relocating pets from overpopulated parts of the U.S. to areas of high demand, the ASPCA runs the largest nationwide network. Here are its current source and destination states. The sources are, in fact, in the central and eastern south, including Arizona, Oklahoma, and everything south, and the Carolinas, Tennessee, and Arkansas are the border between the south and the north. Texas is in a gray area, so that means it's both, meaning both the source and the destination of these animals. Lots of purple, which means the destination, and that's in the northwest, and then down into Utah, Colorado, and Kansas, and then east of the Mississippi, north of the other border states. And then there are blobs of white that apparently aren't included, which are Nevada and the Great Plains states, Montana, Wyoming, Nebraska, South and North Dakota. And then there's one scrunched here in the middle, West Virginia, and then a couple in the Northeast. So these are all animals that have either come from the source in the South and are going to the North, or those few scattered states that are both. Okay, back to the text. When Michelle Anderson first volunteered at the Oktibbeha County Humane Society, its challenges could be measured with a simple formula. Like many shelters, it calculated its live release rate, the number of animals that left alive, divided by the total number that came in through the door. In 2009, it hovered around 50%. I remember, if we had a cat that sneezed, we didn't keep the cat, Anderson recalls. No new animals filled the door of the shelter every day, and there was neither the space to house them nor the money to pay the staff to take care of them. But Anderson saw a way to change that. OCHS occupies a tidy brick house on the industrial edge of Starkville, the thriving home of Mississippi State University. Inside, every inch is devoted to animals in their care, with barking dogs and prowling cats behind every door and supplies stacked in every corner. Outside, a fenced-in green grass backyard gives the dogs a place to play. But the social heart is the iron bench on the little porch out front, often busy with chatting veterinary students from the university and volunteers. It was there that Anderson, who joined the shelter's board of directors, oversaw the arrival of a transformative visitor, the Rescue Wagon, and that's spelled W-A-G-G-I-N apostrophe, a green van with a giant puppy decal on the side. It belonged to PetSmart Charities, the philanthropic arm of the pet store chain. The first year it came to Oktabaya, in 2009, it picked up 40 animals, a handful at a time, and transported them to places like Kansas City and Chicago. So Kansas City and Chicago would be in either the destination or the combination destination and source states. Over the next few years, the rescue wagon raised that to several hundred. But it really wasn't doing anything, Anderson says. It wasn't addressing the broader challenge in the community. OCHS was far better resourced than many of its Mississippi neighbors. It had the social capital of the university to draw on and a contract with the city of Starkville to take in strays. By many measures, Mississippi's the poorest state in the U.S., and in nearby communities, animal control was more likely to be a fenced-in area alongside the town dumper behind the sheriff's department. OCHS had professors of veterinary medicine advising on best practices, but places like Winston County, 25 miles away, struggled to provide basic necessities to the animals in its care. Anderson, who works as an administrator at the university, saw a way for OCHS to step up our game. They would transport in more animals. At first, it seemed anathema. The goal was to have fewer. But if OCHS could act as a hub, consolidating the work it took to prepare animals for transport, it could reap the rewards of volume. Instead of rescue wagon coming down for five animals, they were able to fill the truck entirely, says Anderson. They began working with partner organizations to bring in more dogs and a growing list of transport partners to ship dogs out. From 2009 to 2019, OCHS's live release rate skyrocketed from 50% to 95%. Rather than euthanizing every other animal, it found homes for all but 1 in 20. Last year, the little shelter sent out 1,842 dogs and 844 cats on transports, about two-thirds of which came in from partner organizations. If we did not have transport, it would be devastating for us and the groups we work with, says Anderson. It has transformed the lives of these animals and the people who are dealing with these animals, because now they have some hope. Now, I'm going to skip ahead through this article and read the last couple of paragraphs. It says, a crescent moon hangs over the Mississippi pre-dawn. After a night at Hampton Inn, the ASPCA's drivers, Mel Rock and Jess Tippy, beep the van back up to the OCHS door. The staff gathers round, and Tippy checks the paperwork on an iPad and shuffles the printed rabies certificates in plastic sheaths. All the health certs were good? Rock asks. Then the dogs start coming. A 20-year-old volunteer cradles Button, a tiny dachshund she's been fostering at home for 10 days. Rock and Tippy had already labeled the crates strapped into the back of the van, determining in advance where each animal would go. Their moves are all choreographed and codified by the ASPCA, from closing the van door while each animal's loaded in to changing out their surgical gowns and gloves to prevent the spread of any illness. Andrea Spain, a professor of English at the university, who runs her own small rescue, brings over Michelle Obama, Mo for short, a nine-month-old Rottweiler mix who jumps in circles. Rock fills a red watering can with bottled water, then slips its thin spout through the mesh crate doors, filling each animal's bowl for the all-day journey. It is 38 dogs in total, and also a webbing of ties between communities, in Starkville, in Mississippi as a whole, at the destination shelter in Kansas City, wherever the dogs end up. When the truck leaves, OCHS has space for 20 new animals. Not for long. No sooner than we get a couple of kennels open, here comes a newbie, Cotton says. There is a door they open somewhere, and it's just like, who let the dogs out? Blum, who wrote this article, Andrew Blum, B-L-U-M, is the author of The Weather Machine and Tubes. And here's the picture again of the volunteer. Oh, maybe she's a staff member. Danielle Bowes in the blue coveralls. A care and adoption counselor at Second Chance moves Zelda from the crate she flew in. Here's a quote from the item that I skipped over within the text, and it's by Dr. Phil Bushby. Transport is bailing water out of your basement. Spay-neuter is turning the faucet off. You have to do both. And here's a quick rundown of some more of the animals in the photos. This guy looks like he's in a plexiglass cage. He's got a grid at the ceiling. It's Presley, 8 weeks. And Pookie, 10 weeks. And Hazel, 18 months. Will be adopted immediately. Presley's a little brown guy, and he's got big floppy ears and big paws. And the person, or the dog person, standing next to the big stainless steel bowls is Pookie, who is 10 weeks. And then Hazel has attractive large blue eyes, a black muzzle. She has big, tall, pointy ears, as if she might have some German Shepherd in her. But she's tan with a little bit of white belly. And Hazel, at 18 months, is said to be adopted immediately. So that's a rundown on, what's it called? The Dog Runs. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Today's program is underwritten by G. Suggs Insurance. Please contact G. Suggs Insurance, your local independent agency, for trusted advice on home, auto, business, and life insurance. For more information, please visit gsuggsinsurance.com or call 919-875-8889. Time Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. 832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.